Hello, hello, and welcome to my podcast, Love People Technology Learning. And I'm your energetic host, Tamara Kacharova, CEO of Lanes AI, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have you join us once again for an electrifying dive into thought-provoking conversations. On my podcast, Love People Technology Learning, we dive deep into the intersection of humanity and innovation. Join me as we chat with learning and development experts from the world of business, education, and personal development about how people and technology come together to shape our world. We explore how culture, literature, creativity, travel, and human relationships influence personal growth and skills development. Discover the values and meta-competencies of the 21st century that drive the progress of countries, cities, and entire industries, and why they matter. But this podcast, it's not just about insights and theories. It's about embracing the joy of life and making a positive impact. Through inspiring stories, we are on a mission to make people's lives happier and more fulfilled. My mission is simple yet powerful: to spread happiness, ignite curiosity, and make learning a breeze for everyone, everywhere.
Sometimes there's a sense of, oh, if I hadn't done that, then this, right? Here's an interesting thought experiment. Even if I go back to, should I stay in the company or should I leave? When I thought about leaving the company at that time, I had an imagination about what would happen. And I had an imagination about what would happen if I stayed. Now, I stayed and I was wrong in my imagination. Things were different. If I had left the company, things wouldn't have turned out the way that I thought they would. So what happens to us when we go looking back in the past, we compare what really happened to what we thought would happen.
I think that's learning and development. It's not about survey and about feedback. It's about mindset, to change the mindset. And we cannot measure the mindset, how it was changed. And always we need if you want to check what happened, you need to check it before, in the process, after, and you need to continue.
I would like to be alive in the stage of humanity and the stage where we as a planet are finding ways for everyone to win instead of just one hemisphere, or instead of just one flag, or instead of just one pigmentation, or instead of one DNA set, or, I want to live in that era.
Yes, great era. It's a big dream. I hope we will see. We'll see. In this episode, I want to share with our listeners that I'm testing a new podcast format. It features successful stories and case studies where each guest and professional from the learning and development field across various industries shares their success stories about specific projects. They explain how these projects were implemented, the steps taken, which our listeners can actually replicate within their own companies and businesses. This format aims to provide valuable insights for people in the development field, helping them to improve and innovate within their companies. And today, my guest will be Jim B. Clark, Box creator, Integrate founder, Brains of the Beach co-founder, and Jimba's primary role is to help his clients to achieve breakthrough results by providing meaningful, memorable, and magical learning experience. So sit back and get ready for an inspiring journey into the life and insights of one of the tech industry's most forwarding thinking leaders. Welcome to our show. And Jimba, when I thought about our meetings, I'm really glad you are on my podcast today. And I still remember our warm and friendly meeting at the learning conference in Seattle. And I also remember, the brunch the next day with the leaders and experts from the learning and development industry in Seattle, and not just in Seattle. And at that branch, I really noticed and like you and realized that I feel very comfortable with you. And I felt such kindness and sincerity in our conversations. And we talked about life, different countries, like family, business, travel. And it really impressed and inspired me. It's why you're here with me, because for me, it's a great opportunity to meet people who can make our listeners better, and maybe to open, sometimes just open for 1 inch or 2 inches, the new doors, and for me too, because this podcast, Love People Technology Learning, it's about people technology learning and about the love. Yes. And I really appreciate for your coming. In my podcast, we will talk about learning and development experience. And of course, my first question always about your experience, maybe you, Jimba, at the very start of my podcast, could you please talk about your career journey? Because it's really interesting career. You've been in the learning and development industry, I know, for over 25 years, I think maybe 35 years, yes? And even I've read a little about yourself, of course. Yeah, I prepared something about you in my podcast. And even your first job had a global scope covering more than 20 countries, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, China. And share with us how you got to this point in your career and what you are currently working on.
The simple story, because there is no such thing as a truly simple story, is I moved to Taiwan in 1987, and I started working in adult English language education. And in 1992, I joined a company that did English education with no classrooms. It was called Actual Living English. And the idea was the best way to learn a language is to travel to that country. Yeah. But if you can't travel to the country, we bring the country to you. So for 10 years, I was the head of learning and learning, it was a membership club. We had over 100,000 members in Taiwan. And I was the academic director for that. And what I really learned through that experience was how adults learn, and even more importantly, how we don't. Because adult education and adult learning is fundamentally different from childhood education and children's learning. And because we had no classrooms, everything had to be experiential. So we would have disco parties with 500 people. We would take people traveling. We would go bungee jumping. Anything you can do in English. And in the heyday, we had over 150 native English speakers that were planning and running these events across Taiwan. What I learned was adults want to learn, but I always say this, the learner learns what the learner wants to learn. The student studies to pass the test. And we, in our education system, create students who learn how to pass tests, opposed to adults that want to learn. And so if you want an adult to learn, it has to come from the inside out, not the outside in. There needs to be some need and some desire and some recognition that this is of benefit. And so I had a chance to practice creating events, creating experiential learning, taking people traveling, running, all kinds of things. So I had kind of this greenhouse of learning. And during that time, I went to a training. My brain, my heart, my soul was exploded. And it was called Business in You. It was run by a guy who just recently passed named David Neenan. But the whole idea of this was, how can we accelerate learning? How can we make... And he was really involved in accelerated learning, NLP. And so I ended up following him around the world, putting posters up and being the MC or the DJ for him. So I had a chance to learn about experiential education and then about accelerated learning. Then the third piece that I learned was about facilitation. And in Taiwan, I met an organization called ICA, the Institute of Cultural Affairs. Mm-hmm. And they are what I would call hard facilitators or process facilitators. Mm-hmm. And so I really learned about strategic planning, strategic thinking, you know, facilitation, large groups, small groups. So my journey incorporated experiential learning with accelerated learning, with group facilitation, all kind of wrapped in a wrapper of exercises and experiences that were outside of the normal classroom. Mm-hmm. And then I started my own business in 2005, mm-hmm. where I took everything I'd learned from all of that and got to put that into organizations. And so I got super lucky. I would have never expected, to end up in Asia for so long. I would have never expected to have worked in this crazy wild company running all these different experiential things. And then to be able to turn that into a business and now turning that into a product, I mean, mm-hmm. living on it. It's my life. I was just talking to the sales guy at the ATD for the sales booth.
Yeah.
And I keep ghosting him because he wants to help me, you know, sell more. I said, mm-hmm. I'm living a life that's larger than my business. So I don't think about the business. I'm too busy enjoying my life.
Yes, absolutely. Oh my God, it's true. It's true. It's about me too. I think I'm doing my own business because like I'm enjoying my life, and like to be entrepreneur, it's really so hard, and it depends from you, from your team, and always you are thinking about what happened, because like in my business, we have 100 people all over the world, and like every day you need to think about like them, just about customers, and just like in the end of this process, you are thinking about you, about something, what happens with you. But like in another hand, I understand when you have like 3 kids, like you want to join your life, you want to travel and like spend time sometimes more with your kids and like with the family, with friends all over the world. Entrepreneurship can give you this opportunity in the other hand. Because you know that you have a great team and you trust them. And without this, you cannot do this one. And it's like always like you are, okay, this hand or this hand. Like right now, I can do this one or this one. Like enjoy your life or like work. But it's a balance and you need to juggle these things. But like, yes.
What you said there is really beautiful about, you know, this and this. In my generation, you know, it was a this or this, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to get this. Either I have time with my family or I take the promotion.
Absolutely.
I still remember calling my wife and saying, hey, you know, I'm being offered this promotion. It's going to mean I have to travel to all these different countries. I'm not going to have as much time with you and the kids, you know, and there was, you know, and her reply was kind of like, it was like, hey, you're already busy enough right now. We don't even know if you're here. So just go ahead. We won't notice any difference, you know, and that really kind of opened my eyes to what was going on. And I had a conversation with my dad and my uncle, and we came up with this concept of working retirement. If you talk to someone in their 60s or 70s, as you know, I graduated from high school in 1982. Mm-hmm. And so right now, I think we just had our 40th reunion recently. People are talking about retirement at my age, but mm-hmm. they're not talking about it as I never want to work again. They're talking about mm-hmm. it as working retirement.
Yeah.
And the concept that we created back in my 20s and 30s was, why don't we have a working retirement in our 20s? Mm-hmm. Like if you ever work at a 30s, if you can start that working retirement mindset before you have, you know, a mortgage, before mm-hmm. you have kids and call, you know, if you can just say, hey, how much is enough? Mm-hmm. Right. And how do I not get this or this? How do I get this and this? And, you know, as you're talking about your story of traveling, it's an integration of life rather than a segmentation. And I think we're really taught from a very young age, oh, when you go to work, don't talk about, you know, don't be, that's work.
Yes, just work.
Put on your work box and don't feel too much. Yeah. Don't think too much. Don't care too much, because that's just a company.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's the other way. I think it can be another way around, which is, well, imagine a life where you're living a life of joy. And then you give yourself that question. How do I live a life of joy, of contribution, of respect and being respected? Then it becomes so much easier to be integrative than if my question is, how do I make money and spend it on my family? It's I'm really fortunate in that regard. And fortunately, I married the woman I married, because every time we have a conversation about this, she's very clear. Hey, so right now we have a family business. It's me, my wife and my daughter. We want to impact the way the world thinks. And so that's the number one value. The number one value isn't about revenue. Number one value isn't about, you know, growth. The number one value is, how can we make an impact on the way the world thinks? Mm-hmm. And every time I come up with a plan for exponential growth, do you really want to do that? Is that really how you want to spend your time this year? Is this really important enough for you to do that? And you're like, well, I don't know. So why don't we just keep doing what we're doing and make it organic and let our energy carry us forward rather than some kind of a artificial target?
Yeah. And you know, now you're told interesting like point about that it's a family business. And for me, always, it's so interesting question about how is it to be in business like a family? I heard a lot of opinion, like a lot of opinions about that. Like, how does it work when you are always with your family, like at home, in business, and like, how does it work? Like many, many years in your family. And maybe you will share maybe like some of your insights. And if our listeners want to make some business, like some kind of business and training and development with the family, they will hear it and say, okay, I want to do that with the family. Oh no. Okay. No, it's not for me. Okay.
Well, I'm fortunate. First of all, I met my wife as we were creating all these events back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so our job was to co-create these events. So we were already working on doing cool stuff together. And when we had children, she was clear that she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom in the early stages. And that turned into homeschooling. So we homeschooled both of our children all the way. Mm-hmm. My son's 23, my daughter's 19. So we homeschooled our kids all the way through. So we are, and I'm working from home. So we already have boundaries that are very unique compared to people who maybe had a more traditional work life and school life. You know, you put someone who's gone all the way through school and say, now you're going to work in the family. It's like, poof. But for in our case, because this is a natural progression of homeschooling. And then I guess the third thing is we genuinely enjoy the work that we do. So it's not like we just enjoy each other as family members, but I think all three of us have different unique gifts to what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And those, so we really just kind of do what we want to do. Mm-hmm. And we don't do so much of what we don't want to do.
Which we don't like. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And if, again, if you're not chasing constant growth, if you're not chasing this, or you're not chasing that, then we can all find our balance pretty beautifully, currently speaking. So getting back to advice, well, number one is don't do it if everybody doesn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, don't make it an expectation of family membership that you are a part of the business. Mm-hmm. And like, even with my daughter, somebody asked me, you know, how long do you hope your daughter stays in the business? And I say one more day, you know, because if it's just one more day, that's great. There's going to come a day, or there may come a day where, you know, she or my wife or even myself says, you know, I want to do something else. I've graduated from this, you know, incubator. Yes. I want to go to this. Great. Because that's what do we really want? Do we want to grow a business or do we want to grow ourselves? We want to grow each other. Right. So the business is the context for love. The business is the context for contribution. So it's just a context, and that context could change. It doesn't mean the love change, doesn't mean support change, it doesn't mean anything else changes. Mm-hmm. It just means that we've chosen a different context to learn together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or apart.
Yes. I love it. I love it. And I think our listeners, if you are like internal L&D experts or like head of L&D chief learning officers, you have a choice. If you want it, you can make your business with the family and like, yes, it's
another.
Yeah.
It's also a timing thing. So let me take you back to the year 2000. I know it's a long time ago, but I'd been in that company for 12 years at that time and had just gotten this promotion. But I also, my son was being born and I was ready to quit. And I told my boss and my wife, and we were going to quit and we're going to start our own business because I had this passion for L&D and I was going to do all this stuff. And my boss, the president of the company said, let me just have breakfast with you and we just talk.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we're sitting there and you know, this is in Taiwan. I was a local hire at an internet, you know, international company. And I said, well, if you stay, we'll let you do this and you'll have this opportunity and this, and we'll give you a housing allowance of $2,000 a month. And my hand just went out and I shook his hand and I said, okay. Like I immediately sold my soul for $2,000 a month.
Oh my God.
And it was a 3 to 5 year, minimum 3, maximum 5 year deal. And I felt so guilty for the first year and a half because I was like, oh my God, I sold my, you know, it's like I literally had this imagination of the phone ringing and it's like, hi, this is your passion. This is what you really want to do. And I'm like, hey, can I just put you on hold?
No.
You know, I'm just going to put you on hold for 3 years. And I felt so guilty. I felt so shameful. And I kicked myself for like a year and a half. And then I started realizing, wow. You know, in this last year and a half, I've been able to do some really cool things. And wow, I've got a whole new budget to work on this. And I got to learn Six Sigma, which is something I would have never learned. I got all this. Oh, and then, so then when I finally left the company 5 years later, not 3 years later, guess what? My savings had quadrupled. So in those 5 years, I grew as a human being. I created a safe environment for us to have our first two, our two kids. I was able to save money because I was spending less money on other things. And when I left and started my business, I was a better consultant. I was a better father. I was just better. And so if you are in the L&D world and you are thinking, gee, should I leave behind my cushy job, or even though it's not really cushy, you know, do I have my golden handcuffs and do I keep doing this, or should I run out and travel the world like Tamara and Jimbo and just do all these wonderful things? Whatever you decide, when you decide, is the best decision.
Yes, absolutely.
So if your heart is saying yes, but your mind is saying no, then say no. Wait until you know this is what you and your is best for you and your family, because it is a huge difference and it is scary.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. I remember. I think my last year in the company internal was in 2013, 11 years ago. I remember my feelings because it was like, you know, like hardest decision in my life. I've been chief learning officer in the biggest investment company, and like I had a great salary, great team. It was great time. And like, yes, I was like really a success in my career. But like one day I remember that I woke up and I asked myself, okay, do you have like something which you did not do on this company for the people? Do you have motivation to do that every day? Do you have a passion about your work? Because like I'm a person who is in passion the same to do work. And I remember that like for these three questions, I did not have like answer yes. I had like answers no. And it means I didn't have energy to do my best work, best job. And we had an idea for the business with my partners, like which I've met like several years before. And I thought maybe it's a good opportunity. It was really hard decision. And the same, I came to my head of like, she was a VP of HR and it was a VP of sales of the company. And I had meeting with them. And of course, first of all, they asked me, we want to give you
the biggest salary and like something, because like you are doing with the team great work and like people in the company know you, your team, and they love everything what you are doing with the team. Okay, we want to save you. And I tell, no, just like, okay, 2-3 months, I can do my work, like to finish it, to prepare like my team. But like, if you are great head, you don't need to prepare your team, because your team, the best doing something without you. And like, yes, I did my work for last like 2 or 3 months. I came out from the company. Like first months I did like traveling, did my some vacation. And after that, I back home and I started crying in the kitchen. I remember, because it was just like, you know, my computer, like, and nothing, just like my knowledge. And I remember I was crying every day, because from my position, like my highest position, VIP position, when I was like, you know, I knocked like to every doors and it opened like from my first knock knock. Now I was in another position, because I was a networker and I needed to talk with the same people, like VP of learning, chief learning officers in other companies. But like they, like some of them knew me, but like most of them no, because like I was just like Tamara from some learning company and that's it. And I need to call them, write them, and like, oh my God, I did not do this and I wasn't prepared myself, but I had a great idea of the product and it helped me. And it's like, it's a great advice for people who wants to make something in a business. If you have a great idea and you trust and you believe in it, you can do it. Like without some idea and like some support, it's like, it's a big question, like yes or no. I think no.
I mean, because I mean, let's face it, your job, even with the great team and the great salary, it was hard. It was still hard work, right? I mean, going down this solopreneur or even, you know, entrepreneur path, it's going to be as hard or harder, but you can't lean into, well, at least I'm getting paid. Well, at least my kids have really good insurance. Well, at least, you know, I got this beautiful mm-hmm. apartment's being paid by, you know, these kind of things are those, you know, those. It's the non-integrative approach, right? So it's the trade-off approach, right?
Yeah.
And when you go into this other side, it becomes much more of an integrative approach. I've lost that, but I've gained this. And I can, you know, think of three very distinct times in my first 4 years of starting my business where different things happened. And I went to my wife and I was saying, I'm the only bread earner. You know, mm-hmm. we agreed that she was going to be stay at home. Yeah. So I've got to, you know, I'm it. And I was saying, you know, 3 years in, I'm thinking maybe I've learned enough here. Maybe it's time for me to go back to corporate, you know, mm-hmm. while I'm still relevant. If I stay out too long, it's going to get harder and harder for me to go back. And I was thinking maybe it's time for me to do that. And her response was just golden all three times, which was, okay, if that's what you really want, you know, if this is what you really want, but my only request is that you're not doing this out of fear mm-hmm. or that you're not giving up on your dream because, you know, you're sacrificing that for your family. Mm-hmm. And so as long as, you know, you'll never say, well, yeah, I kind of gave up on my dream for the family. Sure. Whatever you want to do, I'm supporting you 100%. And every time I was just like, okay, I'll go back and do my dream. You know, if I have to, thank you. You know, it's like I really wanted, like I wanted her to say, okay, good. I'm out too. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm so appreciative of this. Let's go back.
Yes,
you
know, but that's no, what I wanted go in back that to moment. Your dream. Go back to your dream. Like, dream. Oh, no.
And because it's always hard. And if she had said no, mm-hmm. or if she'd say, yeah, let's go back. You know what? Right now, I'd be an exceptionally happy person with a beautiful mm-hmm. family, living a beautiful life, because again, that's just the context to show up. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you were talking about how we, you know, determine whether we stay or go, for me, it came down to, and it still does come down to three things. Number one, am I contributing? You know, I want to do something where I'm contributing. Yeah. I'm making a difference. Number two, am I learning? Mm-hmm. Because there are times where I'm contributing without learning. And the third one is, am I being treated with respect? Mm-hmm. And part of respect is money, but there's so many other parts of respect. And, you know, sometimes I have, before I had to fire myself from my company because I wasn't learning and I wasn't really contributing. I was kind of treated with respect. They treated mm-hmm. me with respect, but I kind of lost that edge. But now I find myself firing clients. And sometimes the money part of the respect is there, but not the other parts. And maybe what they're asking me to do isn't really a stretch for me. And I don't really necessarily agree with the direction. It's mm-hmm. not like they're doing something bad. It's just, I don't think I'm the best person to do that because it's not in my zone. And so, I mean, in the last few years, I've passively aggressive fired mm-hmm. a few clients. And by passive aggressive, what I mean is I just double my rates. And then if they say yes, then I say, okay, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, life is too short, especially if you've gone to this side of the deal and you say, I'm going to be an independent, there's something that's driving you. And then if you start making trade-offs, you know, over a period of time, then it's really going to be hard to stay over on, mm-hmm. for me to stay on this side of the deal.
I love it. And I love conversation when you can make it like so natural and like it was unexpectable to me to talk about like entrepreneurships. But like I love it. And I think it's really useful for some of listeners because it's, I think like a lot of people from learning and development, now it's a great opportunity to be out of the box.
It's also one of the many things that many of us learned in COVID. If I'm working on the puzzle called life and I'm only trying to find one piece of the puzzle, money, status, you know, development, if I'm really working on the puzzle of life from the position of this is the one piece I'm trying to place, what about all the other pieces? What about all the other parts mm-hmm. of the puzzle? And so, especially when you think about going out of the box, if every time I'm going out of my box, it's for the company, it's mm-hmm. for performance, then what that means, I facilitated strategic workshops in Asia where there's, you know, a real propensity towards overwork. People in a 2-day, 3-day strategic planning workshop will come up with fabulous ideas mm-hmm. that they can't do within the scope of their current work time. And so then to implement those ideas, the going out of the box becomes, I'll go home 1 hour later. Mm-hmm. I'll work weekends. And they start to, I'll never forget, I had he was a Chinese manager, and he said, I want to stop watching my children grow longer, mm-hmm. was his sentence. Like, my children grow longer? That doesn't mm-hmm. make sense. He goes, yes, mm-hmm. when I leave in the morning, my children mm-hmm. are laying in bed.
Yes.
And when I come back at night, my children are laying in bed.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching them grow longer. Yes. I want to watch them grow up.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God, I have a goose skin right now. Like, yes. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Yes.
And in that room, the whole room went silent because everybody was making trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And the going out of the box had a lot to do with, I'll go out of my expectations for my health. I'll go out of my expectations for my family or for this. And where I think real creativity comes from, we say, I want it all.
Yes.
I want a career and I want money and I want loving relationships and I want to be healthy and I want travel and, you know, and I want to be a part of my family's life and I want to write a book and why not yes. be creative about that instead of I want my boss to be happy?
Yeah.
I want to get a promotion. Yeah.
Yes. But like, you know, it's our choice, like every day. And you told that if you have a decision, it's the best decision right now. And if you have a choice, it's the best choice right now. And I think it's Milton Erickson's star, right? Like he has in his star 5 position, like I'm okay, you are okay. And like, I don't remember a third of them. It's about like, if you do your choice, it's the best choice, best decision right now. And you don't need to think about like, if you are doing that, it's wrong. No. you cannot check it. If you do that, it's the best way. Yes. And like, and I think the last principle of his star, it's about all changes are the positive for us. Nothing negative, like just positive difference. Like, yes, and all changes are good.
In our family and in our programs is everything's a prototype.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Including me.
Absolutely.
And this
hypothesis.
Is today's prototype.
Hypothesis.
Yeah.
Which we are, you know, testing.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's an A-B test, but no, mm-hmm. in general, I mean, everything's a prototype. And there, the other thing about, you know, sometimes there's a sense of, oh, if I hadn't done that, then this, right? Here's an interesting like thought experiment. Even if I go back to, should I stay in the company or should I leave? When I thought about leaving the company at that time, I had an imagination about what would happen. And mm-hmm. I had an imagination about what would happen if I stayed. Mm-hmm. Now, I stayed and I was wrong in my imagination. Mm-hmm. Things were different. If I had left the company, things wouldn't have turned out the way that I thought they would. Mm-hmm. So what happens to us when we go looking back in the past, we compare what really happened to what we thought would happen,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so we think, oh man, I made a mistake because I got this mm-hmm. reality instead of this over idealized, romanticized version of my future. And nothing good comes out of that other than next time I have a certain kind of situation like this, let me A-B test that and I'll choose the other choose the other result instead of this and I'll prototype that out. It's fun to do that. It's easy to do that with program design because we have a chance to run things over and over again over time. But we're also doing that with our lives. We're doing that with our thinking all the time.
Yes, it's true. And I love what you said about prototype. Yes. And, you know, Jimbo, now I want to talk to you about your project because, like, you know, not all of our listeners know about your, you know, about your most successful projects which you have. And now today I want to talk to you about that. And it's like, you know, for my podcast, it's I'm testing a new podcast format. And today, like, it's the first one about like really successful story about the project about like project which some of our listeners can listen about and like maybe they can implement it to their work or maybe they can create some like project like this one and like you will tell us not just like I will ask you some questions and it will help our listeners like will understand how to do that. And like, can you walk us through one of your most successful projects, which I think I know about what maybe. Yes, but like share, please. Like the name of this project and like several worlds about that, why you are choosing this project.
Yeah, sure. So I have a product, tool, methodology, experience around thinking out of the box. And so we take the phrase think out of the box literally with a physical box. And we use this as a way to challenge mindset. We use this as a way to challenge people's thinking about the future, about what they think they can get. We as human beings have learned how to make goals that we have a high chance of succeeding at so we don't feel failure. And we would say rather than, you know, asking for less, why not ask for more and let the creative side of you take mm-hmm. you know, control more. And how this all started was almost 15, in fact, this year is our 15th anniversary of the first time I did this. It was just after the financial crisis in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a client that came to me. I'd worked with him before the financial crisis. And he said, I need you to do a workshop with my leadership team. They want to go back to the way things were before instead of forward to the way things need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Can you run a program on out-of-the-box thinking? And like every good consultant, if a client says, can you? The answer is, Well, yes, of course I can. It's what I do best.
Yeah, it's true.
Right? And I was in my office and I was thinking, okay, so if I want them to think out of the box, what is the box? And on the floor was an empty box, a paper, but like an A4 paper box. And so I put it on my head. And I said, okay, this is in the box thinking. This is out of the box, in the box, out of the box. I was like,
wow.
We will put boxes upon their heads and it will be fabulous. And so I got
did you prepare like 10 boxes from like, I don't know, from
stuff even better. Even better. I got virgin cardboard, never used, big flat sheets of cardboard, box cutters, tape, markers, and we made boxes and then we just talked about it. Like, hey, when you put this on, you know, cutting holes. And so it was just a crazy idea. I thought, you know, he asked for out of the box. We have some trust. And it worked out well enough for me to try again. And so here's the number one thing for your listeners. If you have a crazy idea and you have the trust of a leader or the trust of a team or trust of a group, try it. Everything's a prototype. So if you don't try it, you don't know. That's number one. Number two, at the end of the day, I knew that there was something beautiful in there. It was like, you know, I got a lump of coal, but I know it can be a diamond, but I don't know how. And so as I went on for the next 3 or 4 years, every 3 to 6 months, I'd slip it into a program design and it would never work the way I wanted it to, but it always made something really unexpected and beautiful show up. I can honestly say this, it bothered me. It bothered me that I couldn't make it work. I couldn't, you know, it's like. And so then this is my second thing, which is if you've got this feeling that there's something in there and I've got to tease it out and it's frustrating you, oh my God, don't give up on that, because that is your unique special gift to the world. And probably you're the only one that's ever going to think, oh yeah, I should put boxes on people's heads. You know, I should learn how to do this. Right.
Yes.
And so I just kept teasing it and I kept repeating it. And finally, after I did it about with 500 people, I started cutting boxes beforehand instead of asking them to cut it. And then after about 1,000 people, I went to a packaging company and worked on a design. So I thought, well, let's print these things, save time. And you know, I don't have to worry about insurance for that. You got 15 people with box cutters. It's really dangerous. It's been a never ending iteration process. And every time I think I got it figured out, I think, oh yeah, then I'll do it again and it just won't quite work as well. And I'll have to redesign it. And then for me, one of the biggest shifts came when a client came to me and said, hey, we'd really like to use this for inclusion, diversity, and belonging. Could you train our internal trainers to run your program? So then all of a sudden they paid me to create my online train the trainer program. Once my brain shifted from what can Jimbo do to what can someone in Sri Lanka do? What can someone in India do? India. What can someone in Japan do? Now you've really got to get it down to the basics. And so this would be the other thing I would say to your listeners, let your market find you. And what I mean by that is, yes, I created this box thing. During that same period of time, I created 5 different simulations. I created a card-based personality profiler. I created all these different things. And some of them I liked more and did more often, but the market came and asked me about this box thing. And so finding out from the market what they want. And then every time I got stuck, my way of breaking through being stuck was to get people who I respect to come into my room and I would take them through where I'm at now and say, how would you design this? People that weren't box facilitators, people, just people I respect. And so never be afraid to ask for help. You know, even as a creator and intellectual property owner, there comes a point in time where my thinking becomes an echo chamber. And so these are, you know, there's a lot of other things, but I was thinking if you're looking at what I've done, number one, listen, try the crazy thought. Number two, listen to your inner gizzard about that these things that bother you that you can't quite make it work and find ways mm-hmm. to make it work. Try a lot of things and see what the customer wants. Bring in people that you respect to help you make it better, help mm-hmm. you improve it. I think those are probably some good chunks that you could.
And like, yes, now I think now you talked about like really some key factors that contributed to its success. Like, do you have like maybe more some really like maybe what were the key factors that contributed to its success? Like maybe some really interesting, I don't know, steps or like things which you did more and like now you can tell us that yes, it was really key factors that contributed to its success.
Yeah, I mean, there, again, if we look at it from a design perspective, we've got a few design principles in how we do what we do. And the first one is about inclusivity. And I live in a country where I am not a native speaker. I live in a Chinese language. I live in a country where I can't read anything because of the way Chinese works. It's not like Spanish where I could guess, right? And so we've taken all the language out of our physical product. Our online learning materials have, you know, one button translation. Every video that we have a transcript. I try my hardest to think about neural diversity too. I've had three of my native English speaker facilitators and trainers come up to me saying, this is the best online learning program I've ever had, because for each page in the learning program, I have a video where I just talk them through the page.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, yeah, you can read this, but here, let me just talk you through what's going on here. And they're like, oh my God, because I can't read a wall of words. Even mm-hmm. as a native English speaker, I just would never read a wall of words. But when you talk me through it, I can find what I'm interested in mm-hmm. and I can dig into that. And so when I'm talking about inclusivity, you know, the reason that we have the same physical product is being used in Saudi Arabia and Russia and, you know, Argentina and Canada and France and, you know, all these 30 different countries is because we designed it for non-English speaking, and we designed it for to be as culturally neutral as possible, which is tough.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is really, really tough, because I want to write stuff and I want people to read stuff. But as soon as you get written down, like for participants, as soon as it moves from the physical, experiential, communicative to the written, you lose 30-40% of your audience.
Yeah. It was one of my questions, because like about diversity and like, you know, inclusion focused, because the fundamental difference, like it's really like difference. It's a crazy all over the world. Like I know about learning product, like how to be ensured that's like it's the same for people with different culture code, and the work which you did with your team, it's really amazing. Like, yeah, it's a great big work. I remember many, many years ago, we did like, because like first time when we just started our business in Lanes, we did a simulation and like serious games, virtual serious games. We designed it, created like, yes. And it was really first simulation all over the world. And I remember one simulation was for like for France, for China, for Arabic countries. And like, we needed to be ensured that people from Arabic countries can understand the same, like, examples in, like, simulation. I think it was a security awareness, some kind of simulation like this one. And I remember that we prepared, we had experts from different countries. And the example, when you're working in your workplace in Arabic countries and France, it's a difference, because in like Arabic countries, you cannot think about like how to buy some dress or something in a shop, and you cannot find it in a website. like you don't have this idea because it's a different culture code. But like, I think like, okay, in CIS countries, you can do that. And some of employees can like, can write some information in a website and try to buy something in the work time. And it's a different culture code. Like, and like, yes, it's a crazy work, but like you have like 20, yeah.
You know, because we create a lot of simulations. As soon as the player comes across something that doesn't relate to their real world,
yeah,
it pops the bubble.
Absolutely.
Of the simulation.
Yeah.
And they'll say, oh, this isn't realistic. And, you know, again, growing up in Asia, working mostly in Hong Kong, China, Singapore for most of my career in the last 15, 20 years, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, oh, where was this made? Oh, this is China. Mm-hmm. China's different.
Yes,
and they're
always.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're right. Singapore's different. And they're right.
Yes.
And so the way we got around that mm-hmm. is one of our core philosophies is it's not that people don't want to change. There's kind of this myth that people resist change or people don't want to change. If you, every program I ask people a question, I say, do you want next year to be better than last year? Raise mm-hmm. your hand. Everybody raised. There's yeah, nobody absolutely. Wants next year to be same or worse.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That means I want change. I want to change from what I had. So we say it's not that people don't want to change. It's that people don't want to be changed. So change is the door that must be opened from the inside. And so in our processes, because it's very facilitative and very non-judgmental, I always tell people when I'm doing trainer facilitations, whatever they say is the right answer because we're asking them about their inner thinking. And we're asking them about their inner thinking in the context, perhaps, of their coworker. And we're mm-hmm. asking about their inner thinking in the context of coworkers who may have taken advantage of them in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like this context that they're in may not be safe. And so they may really be hedging on what they're sharing or what they're writing or what they're reflecting, because the person sitting next to them may be, in their story of their life, an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Or an and so if it's not safe for them to write down and it's not safe for them to talk about it, why do we want to push them for more?
Mm-hmm.
So instead, why not create a process that is as inviting as we can and give them the power. So the way we handle psychological safety is in all of our process, you listen to a prompt or you do something with the box, you experience something, and then you write. And then after you write, you choose what you want to share. And so what I always tell them is don't write anything that you don't want someone else to see.
Mm-hmm.
I will never ask you to share anything that you don't want to share. But I've had times when somebody wrote, man, I can't wait to quit this company, you know, my boss. And then guess what? The boss looks at that. So this whole idea of non-judgmental, the whole idea of making an invitation to change rather than an expectation, this, when you're starting to cross cultures, then you find out, oh, wow, in this culture, this part of their life is really hard to talk about. And they're not going to talk about the integration with family. They're not going to talk about that part. Mm-hmm. They're going to stay more business. Great. And this part of the culture over here, they don't even want to talk about, you know, this country. They don't even want to talk about business. They just want to talk about how they want to change their life. Great. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to help them get a better mindset to get more of what they want and work in life. I think the biggest part of inclusion is to have less of an expectation on their output.
Mm-hmm.
And a more of an expectation on my openness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love it. Thank you so much. And, you know, it's a great question. I think so. I love this question for myself always. I'm asking about this. And it's interesting for me to listen to you about this point. How did you measure and evaluate the impact of your project? Because, like, you know, it's an interesting question, not just for me, like not just for me, for you, for CEOs, for head of the business who buy your product and like who wants to implement it. And it's interesting.
Yeah, there's a couple ways. I got to be honest with you. with my personality and my style, I don't like, I don't do pre and post surveys. I don't.
Yeah. It's not about a feedback form. Yeah. And survey, like, yes.
One of the cool things about what I do is I've got like 200 facilitators around the world who are using the products, using this methodology, either in their company or in their consulting business. Mm-hmm. So quite often they're the ones that are pushing the envelope more than me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always trying to make things more simple and they're always trying to make things more applicable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Juan Luis Fernandez in Spain, in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was having a hard time convincing his clients that they need to put a box on their head for success. Mm-hmm. Imagine that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
So he shifted from focusing on the tool and the process to focusing on the outcome. And so he started, instead of selling a box program or even a leadership program, he was selling a ongoing mindset shift program. And so there's a benchmarking of your mindset, which is happens in the box. What are you thinking? What do you want now? What are you thinking? And then through the process, we get them to come up with the new ideas. What are you going to change? So now they got a benchmark and what they say they're going to change. 6 weeks later, he does coaching with each one. What you said you were going to do? What have you done? And then he takes those coaching, the results of those coaching sessions, and can go back to the organization now and say, all right, 40% of the people are having a problem with this, 60% are looking for this. This is the help they need. So the process becomes both a strategic vision at the individual and team level, and then a feedback on how it's going, and then a kind of a diagnostic for what's next. And the reason this is so powerful is the way the box programs are set up. We get them to think about their most aspirational outcomes that they really want and what creative things they're willing to try. And then when you go back and you find out where are they having success with what they're trying, where are they not, you're already way ahead of the game in terms of what's next. Instead of doing like a needs assessment or maybe a capability gap or things like that, because you're dealing with aspirations. So I think the way that we measure it, when we measure it at its best, the way we measure it is, you know, how much is really changing and what's next.
Yes.
For me, the other way that I measure, so my face-to-face customers have become more the facilitators than the end users.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2023, I think I only did 4 paid programs, delivery to clients. Everything else was enabling people. So my measure is, do you buy more boxes? Do you find ways of doing this more? Are you able to put this into your business?
Mm-hmm.
Is this you know, contributing to either as a consultant, is this contributing to your bottom line? As an in-house facilitator, is this contributing to the growth of your business?
Yeah.
And so that's the other, the metric I look at is how many repeat customers do I have in my facilitator, and how do I get more people to come back for more licenses to do more work?
Mm-hmm.
That's the other, from my perspective, yeah. That's what I look at.
Yes. Yes, it's great. And you know, you started to talk about like survey or something like feedback forms or like how we like usual measuring like the result of the learning processes. And like when you're like, I think that's learning and development, it's not about like survey and about like feedback. It's about mindset, to change the mindset. And we cannot measure the mindset, how it was changed. And like always we need like, you know, if you want to check what happened, you need to check it before, in the process, after, and you need to continue to do like, you know, always be like, like in YouTube several months ago, I watched the video about she is a scientist who analyzed the behavior of monkeys. And like every day she spent like every day, like through months, like 6 months, 7 months, she and her team, they spend 10 hours per day, 10 hours, like, yes, from 4 a.m., 5 a.m. till 4 p.m. in the forest, and just like watch in the behavior of monkeys. They analyzed the behavior of monkeys about like how they spend time. Like, okay, do they have lovers or no? Like, okay, they're in the family, but they do they have lovers or no? And like 6 months, they like analyzed the behavior. It means if we want to teach someone like to change behavior or something, we need to analyze the behavior every like crazy day, like 10 hours per day to measure the behavior. Crazy. And it's like, I said, oh my God, yes, it's true. Like if you want to like analyze the behavior of monkeys, people like, yes, like let's measure it like every day, not just like just one time. And like your product, it's about behavior. I think so, because like out of the box, you need to change the behavior. You need to show like another way. Like, you know, it's like a keynote speaking. It's not like the answer for the questions. It's just questions inside the people which we have. And like after that, through 1 day, 3 days, months, years, we start, oh my God, yes, I was there. It means like I need to change like the situation with the team, like with the business, with my family and something like, yeah.
As you talk about that, there's one thing as I train my facilitators, we always end a program on behavior. And so the way we do this is when you think about a box has an outside and an inside. So the outside is the branding. The outside is, for humans, the outside is the behaviors. The inside is the thinking, the outside is behavior. So if I change my thinking, like just talking with you tonight, mm-hmm. you know, I was a little bit kind of tired. I've had a bunch of calls, but as soon as I get with you, your energy, my energy, you know, there's something happening on the inside that energizes me. So then that changes my behaviors. Mm-hmm. Suddenly my hands are flying and, you know, all these things are happening because of what's happening on the inside. And in our mindset change programs, we spend time designing a mindset that's going to give you what you want. It's all good intentions. You know, it's kind of a lot of programs when you think about it, at the end of a program, they'll say, okay, take out a paper and write down your three commitments. And we're going to mail these to you in 3 months from now. Or, you know, this is like a New Year's Eve resolution, because you're going to end on something bigger than you can probably do. And so before we end, we talk about what are you willing to try and all these kinds of things. But then where we end it is on the inside. We ended on the outside of the box, which is if you change your thinking, if you remember the changes that you want to make, what new things will others see you do? What new things will others hear you say? You can't answer those questions with anything but a behavior. Then the third one we ask is, if you say those things and do those things, what new feedback will you receive from others? Mm-hmm. And the fourth one is, if you do those things, you say those things and you get that feedback from others, then when you look in the mirror, how will you feel differently about the person mm-hmm. that you see? So now, just by asking those four questions at the end, we're really just saying, what are the natural results of change? And it's not, you know, I'm going to lose 20 pounds, because people don't hear you say losing 20 pounds, right? It's got to be things that are going to be active. So then when we go back to the coaching side of it, we go back to the follow-up side, we always start with the behavioral. Did you do these things that you thought you were going to do? Did you get the feedback you hoped you were going to get? Did you change your relationship with yourself? Mm-hmm. Then from there, we can open up our thinking. So, okay, what do we want to try to get more of this or less of that?
Yeah.
I honestly, like, I think the box is genius. I do. I mean, I just do. 15 years of hard work.
Absolutely, absolutely.
but I think one of the parts of the box that I think is real genius is this ending on behaviors and impact on others and self, as opposed to ending on intentions and strategic plans. Planning is cheap, but like getting it to the behavioral part is really important.
Yes, absolutely important. And now you talked about like genius product. And it's my next question about like genius product, because what's doing OpenAI and GPT-4.0. It's something will change the behavior of learning. It's really true. Please share your thoughts like on how the approach to learning and development will like, you know, drastically change in the next couple of years with the advent and development of tools like GPT-4.0. And how do you see your project evolving in the next, I think, 2-3 years? What do you plan to change to stay on trend? Or maybe you're out of the box like genius and you will be on trend like next 5 years. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's really interesting for me because like everything will change. Internet came to us like 20, 30 years ago. Like after that, Web 3.0 like came to our life. Now it's a GPT-4.0, and like everything will change like every 1 year, 2 year. Not like it was 20 years ago when we changed something like just 20, like one time period, 20 years. Now it's every year something will change. And did you read the news about, is it like Elon Musk project? I don't remember, about like neural chip in a person who implements with the AI. Can you imagine? It's a true, and it means the behavior of learning will change. And I think training and development departments and like industry will change like a lot. It's not just about ChatGPT, because like all the conference talked about that. It's like, okay, how to implement that. No, now I'm thinking that everything, I think that's, it's true when you have like some chip or something like your assistant and you don't need coaches, trainers, mentors, like nothing, because you can talk like now my the best partner for great conversation, not you, Jimba, it's ChatGPT, of course. And just like if you have a great life experience, I want to talk to you because it's a real life experience. But if you don't have really great life experience, okay, ChatGPT will help me. I don't need some information or some like training. Now I can train myself with ChatGPT. Like I have a really smart conversation with him, like or with her.
First of all, let me just say, for those of you that are listening, could you just let us, Tamara, what time is it where you're at right now? Could you just say your local time right now?
Now it's 2 a.m., 2:20.
2:20 in the morning. Okay. So if you've listened to this conversation and you hear the passion and the energy that's coming out of this woman at 2:20 in the morning, you know, you can know that just how much she's thinking and feeling and imagining around this.
Can you imagine through 4.5 hours, I need to go to my gym with my personal coach?
I can actually imagine that, having met you. So just a couple of things. Number one, I'm not an expert. I sell cardboard.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean,
I feel it.
At its most basic level right now, I feel really happy to be in the physical, tactile, experiential, human connecting, personal self-awareness, finding balance in life part of the industry. Nobody in ATD is running around saying, how can we do something physical? Everyone is saying, how can we use this technology? So everyone, because they all know there's efficiency, there's money, there's scalability. So number one is, if you've ever read the book Blue Ocean Strategy, or if you know about Blue Ocean Strategy,
absolutely.
My ocean is so freaking blue right now.
Yeah, blue right now. Absolutely blue. Because
everyone's over here being red around AI.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a number of times in what you were saying, you kept going back to learning, you kept going back to L&D, you kept going, which from our perspective is real. But if you're not in this bubble, there's not a single person in the world who's saying, oh, wow, ChatGPT is really going to help me with my learning and development. What it's going to be is either it is going to become my go-to interaction with knowledge, information, and learning, which to a certain degree, even TikTok has become, or, you know, a certain generation, if they want to learn something, will learn it from TikTok before it was YouTube, before Wikipedia, right? So there's always been absolutely. The go-to space. So maybe this becomes that go-to space for, I need to learn how to do this, or I need to know about that. It's going to make so many shortcuts to things. And here's just a simple thing. I read an article about what are some of the big changes in the world because of all what's happening. And one of the companies I talked to is Coursera. And they said that it used to cost $10,000 for each translation of a course. An online course was about $10,000 per course.
Per course.
Of it for an investment. You know what it is now?
Yeah.
20.
Zero. Ah, 20. Okay.
$20. You gotta pay an intern. You know, and it's, you know, I mean, almost, right? So it's gone from 10,000, not to 8,000 or 5,000 or even 1,000 or 100, it's like peanut to zero.
Yeah.
Right? So what does that mean? That means that in Bolivia or in Bogota or in Colombia, you know, all a place that maybe traditionally hasn't had access in their language can have access in their language. It means that content is a commodity and people don't pay for commodities. So on the one hand, it's going to commoditize all of that content. And right now I see all of these platforms trying to create gatekeeping to my, oh, we're experts in this little piece. And so we've got an AI so that you can have, you know, access to our little kernel of understanding that we've been working on for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And in the end, people are going to say, well, who cares? If I don't have your kernel, but I have the rest of human knowledge, I think I can live without your kernel of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So I think leveraging your knowledge is going to become more difficult unless you have very specialized expertise. Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean for us? It just means that we need to be thinking about how the learner learns what the learner wants to learn in the way the learner wants to learn. Mm-hmm. For me right now, what I'm focusing on in my little blue ocean is, as everyone else is thinking about this, can I find ways of making human interaction when we are synchronous, whether it's virtual or face-to-face, can we find ways of making our synchronous interaction more meaningful, more enjoyable? Because I think that's going to be, well, maybe not quite a dying art, but I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of research development competition in that realm. Mm-hmm. And then where I'm looking at AI, I've got a friend of mine, he and I are creating this thing around asking better questions. Mm-hmm. And so we've created a program called Kick Ask. Mm-hmm. So instead of kick ass, it's kick ask. So how do you go from a dumb ask to an ass kicker?
With my accent, it's true kick ass.
Yeah, yeah. And so then I think it's not about providing people with knowledge. It's about making it enjoyable.
It's about life experience with the people. Yes, it's a life. Yeah, it's what I'm thinking every day right now. Because yes, it's true. It's really important because like technology will help us to learn everything by ourselves with the like online coach, like virtual AI assistants, like everything. But how we can have the best experience with the partners, with our team, with our cross-functionals, people, employers all over the world. And it's not about like some theories and like some kind of like just like role-playing or something. It should be something more.
Yeah. Well, even in our program, you know, we get people to write and draw on their box because your brain thinks differently with a pen in it than it does with a keyboard in it and that it does with a phone in it. And your brain will think differently when you're talking to ChatGPT than when you're talking to a human. Just like our connection that we made in the time that we were together face-to-face is different than the connection we can make virtually. And so it's not that one is necessarily better than the others, it's that they're better at different things. There will come a time where I will trade off confidentiality, convenience, and even just those two things, and price to do coaching with ChatGPT, because I know the coach is really just being a mirror for me. Mm-hmm. I know change happens in me, not in this. And so will I sacrifice the personal trainer? You're going to the gym because there's a personal trainer that's going to be there.
Just personal. Yes, because right? I told like, yeah.
And if
I
that person I, wasn't yeah. there, you might say to yourself, well, I was up till 2:30 talking to Jimbo. I can give myself a day off.
Absolutely.
You know, so if ChatGPT is your personal trainer, will you still get out of bed for chat? So there will still always be these things. But guess what I'm so proud of? So I got two kids, right? So my son, he's a baseball player. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, being a baseball player, right? He's a professional baseball player. He's got a very short shelf life as a baseball player, but it's the thing that chat and large, you know, models can't take. They can't take away sports. My daughter's learning facilitation, but she's also learning Aikido. Oh, I think that's great. What a great thing. So maybe someday she'll be both a facilitator and an Aikido master. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain kinds of things that no matter what happens with convenience, price, knowledge, there are going to be certain things that we're going to want humans for. And I think for me, I'm in the space of looking for what are those things and how can mm-hmm. I get better at those? And then use those tools to help me get good at that.
Yes, thank you for these answers. And like, you know, I have some insights about that and like more like deeper insights. It's really true. When we have like this AI, like technological boom, like we need to think how to create something. It doesn't matter with technology or without, but like how to create the great experience for people when they're working and learning together, like from each other. But it's not just like learning, not about theories, not just like about like some exercise or something. Like, yes, it's something more. And yes, it's really true. It's really true. And yes, it's crazy because like we spend 1.5 hours together. For me, it's the end of my day, which started at 6:30. But like in the end of my podcast, always I have like several personal questions about like personality, because like my guests are really interesting people and I want to open their life more like just in professional line. It's my, I think, my favorite question. You, Jimbo, like me, you travel a lot and meet people from different countries and nationalities who speak a very like of languages. And could you share which countries surprised you, what amazed you about them, and what you were not prepared for?
My first area of travel from the very beginning of traveling was Asia. So I've done extensive traveling around Asia. And it's just now, as I've created this global brand, where I'm traveling in Europe for fun and for work and the Middle East. And so I think the two places that come to mind just right off the top of my head, one is Riyadh in Saudi. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to go there twice last year. And then the other was I was just in Serbia.
I will be in July. My great friends live in Serbia and I will be in Belgrade first. It will be my first experience there.
Ask me later. I got a recommendation for a place to go.
Yes, that's great.
And a great conversationalist to meet while you're there. And so I think for me, because we're talking about that, what was surprising, I'm an American, even though I've lived outside of America for 37 years. You know, I grew up on the Rocky movies and on, you know, Rambo, and it's the closest I've really been to this kind of, you know, Soviet architecture. And so it was just amazing to me how, even though I think of myself as this world citizen, you know, my passport's, you know, 3 inches thick because of all the stamps, I feel like I'm a fish out of water. Even though the driver that took me from the airport to the hotel was saying, oh, Serbia is a very safe place. Do not worry. We are very safe. Nobody will mess with you. Just don't talk about religion. Religion, we don't talk about. But yeah, we're very, you know, and he's just like, you know, this is a great, don't worry about your wallet. Don't worry about people are going to, you know, take advantage of you. And I live in that culture in Taiwan as well. So, you know, so it's like it was so surprising of just how warm and how beautiful people were, which shouldn't be surprising, just because I'm coming at it from I'm walking into a movie set mm-hmm. from my movies of the 80s and 90s. And once I let go of that, oh my God, I had a great time. I met such cool people and went to wonderful places and ate such amazing food and drank such amazing alcohol and, you know, all the laughter and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And then in Riyadh, you know, my partner's in Riyadh, a company called Growship. And, they're just such genuinely cool, wonderful, caring, loving, astute businessmen who are so willing to to share with me about their culture from a position of I want to teach you, but just like, and we have these beautiful conversations about just the beauties mm-hmm. of our culture. And I have I'm really lucky to have a true friend there, a guy named Thamir, and he's just so willing to share. Something will come up and he says, oh, well, you know, in our religion, we say, or in our culture, we say, and there's such gorgeous, beautiful sayings. Mm-hmm. And it's just coming from a beautiful space of love and care and a willingness to make things better for people. And my unconscious bias is, oh my God, look at all these people, you know, they're dressed so different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's almost embarrassing to realize just how much unconscious judgments I have to languages, the sounds of languages, and how it triggers, you know, like this, oh, you know. So I wouldn't say it's surprising. It's reaffirming that everywhere around the world, there will be a certain percentage of people who are trying to take advantage of others. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain percentage of people that if you make it easy for them, they will take advantage of you. The majority of the human race is really willing to be beautiful to each other, mm-hmm. if that's where you start, yes. from. I had an epiphany when I guess it was after this year 2000, when I stayed in the company and I realized I will only work long-term with people that I love, and I have to work with people I don't like. Mm-hmm. So that means I have to learn to love, yes. those people.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So how do I open myself up, yeah. to the point where I am willing to love the people I don't like?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes, it's my insight. Yes, we learn a lot from people who we don't like, don't understand sometimes. Yes, we don't want to understand the another, something which we really can understand. It's why we don't like it, because our brain and our heart is not open for this knowledge and like about something. And, you know, one day I think I really understood that, like, you can learn a lot from people who is really so strange for you, like strangers. Not like you don't like them, but they're strangers, like something wrong. But it's like in your, like, it's just in your page, something wrong. But like, if you change the page, it will be another page. And here it's not like something strange, because like another picture, like another story, another like characters, like heroes there. And like, but if you will not turn the page, you don't know how it would be. Mm-hmm.
The way we say that in our programs is, you know, everybody wants to get the out of the box idea. And the easiest way to get an out of the box idea is to listen to someone different than you in mm-hmm. their box idea. Mm-hmm. And especially when you look at the generations, when you look at culture, when you look at all the gender stuff, politics, whatever, the answer to my puzzle may be residing inside your thinking. And as soon as I judge you as other than, separate from, different than, I am no longer willing to listen to and have access to that wisdom. Mm-hmm. But when I start to look at it from a yes and together and, then suddenly I get access to your wisdom. I get access to your network. I get access to so many other things. And so this, we're taught to see differences rather than to build alignments. So I feel really blessed to live in a bicultural family, to have lived around the world and to have, you know, cool international friends, yes. like you, because it forces me to, I don't want others to look at me and say, oh, he's a 60-year-old white American male. It's all true.
Yes, it's all true.
It's all true, but that's not me.
Not enough. Yes, and it's
right?
Yeah.
And so right. If I don't want people to put me in the 60-year-old white American male box, I've got to not put them into the Saudi Arabian, whatever box. And so it's about really becoming boxless. I had a chance to do, just last little story here. I had a chance to do a program with the C-suite of Walmart in China with using the box. And we were in the Hard Rock Hotel is where we ran the program. And so I ended up getting a bunch of guitars from the hotel and I made them create a band. So you're the C-suite. So you gotta know who's the drummer, who's the bass player.
It's great practice.
It's a band.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so then they had to come up with the name for their band. And the name of their band was Boxless. How can we lead without going into our frame of mind and only looking at things from finance? How do we remain boxless? I thought it was really beautiful. And I think it's something, you know, worth trying either to be boxless or maybe unboxable, to live that unboxable life. Which I think you're doing, young lady.
Yes, thank you. yes, it's true. I'm trying to do this because, like, you know, I am white, Armenian, Russian woman. And like, if you know, like, just this one, like, it's a mix, but like, okay, I'm white, like, and that's it. And nothing more. But like, when you start to learn the story about like every person, like, and you, like, you know the story, and if you really want to know more about the personality, like, you open new page and you go out of the box. Yes, because we are not just like something which you see, like, yes, I'm really like smiling and like, yes, great energy, but why? And about that, you know, like, it's a big story. Like, and one day, if you will ask me about that, like, it's a long, long story why I'm a person who I am. And it's the same with everybody.
We can start that before 1 a.m. for you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. But like, you know, I have like my last small questions in the end. But like every my guest ask for three last questions. Really, it's for everybody. And like before that, my last question will be like, outside of your professional life, what are your sources of inspiration? Like, are there practical books, films, like, or public figures that have deeply influenced your like perspective or provided like solace in like tough time maybe?
Yeah, I think I was really lucky. I met a meeting facilitation process called Open Space Technology. It was started by a guy named Harrison Owen, who just recently passed. And in open space, everyone arrives to the meeting with no agenda, just a question to answer. Yeah. There's four principles. You know, whenever it starts is the right time. Whoever comes are the right people. Whatever happens are the only thing that could have. And when it's over, it's over. And that's how you run the meeting. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other things about it, you know, but think that. My wife and I both met that when she met Open Space as she was having our first child. And that really became one of the foundations of our lives, is that, hey, whoever comes are the right people. Today I was running these demo sessions where I had nine people signed up and one showed. And guess what? That person was the right person.
Yes.
What a fantastic time.
Right.
Right. So I can either regret the eight that didn't, or I can enjoy the one that does. If your readers haven't heard of Open Space Technology, if they haven't heard of Owen, it's an amazing process. And the other thing that Harrison did, he created this meeting process. I got trained up in the year 2000, and he never allowed it to be copyrighted, trademarked. You didn't have to pay to use it. He said open space belongs to the world. And so he never intellectualized, propertized that whole thing. And then the other thing that he did was, you'd come, hey, Harrison, can we do this or can we do this? We can do this. And he would say, is that one more thing or one less thing? What's one more? Okay, then don't do it. If you have a suggestion of how we can do one less thing, great. But if it's about one more thing, no, don't make it more complicated. So I would say Open Space Technology changed my wife and my relationship, changed our relationship with our children, changed our relationship with clients, changed my relationship to the business. So
is it like open space? Like, is it Is it like a technique like in virtual or like in...
It started in the 1960s.
Oh, wow.
Basically what happened, Harrison got hired to run a big conference.
Yeah.
And he was in the conference the year before. And so he did a questionnaire at the end.
Yeah.
And the thing that everybody said is, we want more breaks.
Yes.
Can we have longer breaks? The breaks were the best part of the program. And so his design principle was, can I make a meeting technology where it feels like you're on break?
Yes.
And so the whole idea is, you know, they have the four principles. They have what they call the law of 2 feet, which is, if you're not learning and if you're not contributing, then you should walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walk in, you have a question and people write the ideas that they want to talk about. They self-organize. Sometimes it's called unconference. So if you take the Harrison out of it, it could be called an unconference. But I just found the whole thing is so beautiful. I joined the open space community in year 2000, went to a couple of their big global conferences. And, you know, surprise, surprise, these people are all about, you know, let's listen to each other. Let's create a circle. Mm-hmm. What do we have to say? And being very respectful for the sacred space that we as humans can create. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as the space between. You know, between the agenda and the people and the outcomes, there's this space between where the magic happens.
Mm-hmm.
And open space is a conscious way of getting out of the way of letting magic happen. And so when I would facilitate open space, sometimes I would go take a nap.
Yes.
Because once it's going, it's everybody else's passion and their responsibility. You know, so yeah, it's worth looking at.
Yes, I got it. Thank you. For telling me like what happened, like how does it work, like, because I've never heard about this, and like, yes, it's interesting for me. I think I will read more about that, like, and yes, thank you. And my three questions, it's about, like, first, for all my guests the same, what was the last thing you asked ChatGPT?
So I said, hey, I'm curious, what's the difference between polysporin and mupirocin ointment? And the reason is, my dad had an injury and we had, and you know, he needed to put, and so he went to the doctor and the doctor gave him some, and he had some old.
Yeah.
And it's like, do we open the new one or do we use the old one?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I asked, and then, you know, of course, it gave me a very nice thing. And then I said, okay, my 87-year-old father died, but fell, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you should really ask a doctor. And so then we just said, okay, let's just take the one the doctor gave us, you know? But yeah, so there it is. It was the difference between these two very obscure terms.
Is he 87, you told? 87, yes. Where is he, in Seattle?
Yeah.
Yes, he's there, yes. It's great. Now, do you spend time with the,
So that when I went to Training Magazine conference in February, I stayed here for a month.
Mm-hmm.
I go to ATD conference, I stay here for a month. Last year when I went to Learnapalooza, I stayed here for a month.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing is I'm trying to take these kind of conference tent poles and turn them into a month with my dad.
Yes.
Tell your favorite quatrain or lyrics and explain why exactly you choose it and you love it.
I'm not sure what a quatrain is, but I know what a lyric is.
Yeah.
I know the one that okay, so I love Prince. And I love Prince in a way that most people don't. Mm-hmm. In that I probably have about 400 hours of Prince music that I've scoured the web for and downloaded and whatever. The Prince has, this is a quatrain. Yes. Okay. Now I get
it. Yes, it's quatrain.
So I got, okay. So I got it. So in this one, he has a song named, My Name is Prince. And he says, I know from righteous, I know from sin. I got two sides and they're both friends. And for me, this is about the light and the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And people like you and me who shine a lot of light may have a lot of shadow too. And I tend to judge my shadow and I tend to feel guilt and shame about my shadow.
Mm.
And in doing some research in myself and my family, I find out that my family has a long tradition of shame and guilt about the shadow, about not being perfect. And so my mother was a perfectionist, and, you know, it's not easy to be that kind of person. So this quatrain is about, you know, I know from righteous, I know from sin. I know what's right. I know what's wrong.
Yes.
I got two sides and they're both friends. And like my wife always says to me, you know your bottom line. And so I know when to stop drinking. I never get drunk, but I'll have drinks, you know? Yeah. And so I'm really good at knowing how far to go without going over the rainbow. Mm-hmm. And part of this comes from not being overly judgmental about this, about myself. And the other part of it is when I do go over the rainbow, I don't like that feeling, or I don't like that part of me. And so, yeah, so that's my quatrain.
Yes, it's great. And it's about like everyone's, like, yes, it's about everyone. And we have different sides of us, and like, we need to love everything. Like, we need to, yes, trust ourselves, and like, yes. And you told not just like good things we are, but like another way, it's we are too. And it's true. And yeah. And in the end, I have asked the next guest on my podcast. Here's how it goes. Every guest gets to throw a question at the next guest. And like, you know, I believe it adds a unique touch, allowing the previous guest to pose like a question to the next one. And last week, Christina Bars, she's an expert in AI. She was my wonderful guest, and she passed on her question to you. And I ready to answer.
Yeah.
In considering of technology, is it this decade or what decade would you prefer to be alive in today? Like, if it was any decade, but considering the way technology is, because, you know, some people might want to be with the horse and buggy and have like nothing. That's my mother-in-law. Or it'll be like, you know, to somebody who wants to be like 10, 20, 50 years from now for technology. So what decade of technological advancement would you like to be in?
If I think about an age of technology I would want to be in, there's a presupposition that I am wealthy, right?
Yeah.
Because only the wealthy are going to have access.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and so
absolutely.
It's like if this was a TV show and I said, oh, I want to live 100 years from now, I want to be that guy on the street that still has nothing, you know, because for everyone who has that kind of beautiful technology, I would like to be in the age where humans start making choices based on impact on life rather than impact on money or politics.
Yeah.
I would like to hope that humanity is going to last long enough. There comes a point in time where we realize that America is not number one. So I don't know what kind of technology era that would be. And maybe that would be ending up going back to a very, very simple life. But I would like to think that it's possible that humans start looking at things from a big blue marble spaceship Earth perspective rather than a us and them, me and mine. I get paid the big money so I can have 6 cars and all that other stuff. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of technological things that go through. I think there'll be a lot of really terrible things that happen before. But I see two endpoints. And Buckminster Fuller, who you may or may not have heard of, he asked this question once. He said, the cosmic question has been asked, are humans a worthwhile to the universe invention? I would like to hope we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to be alive in the stage of humanity. And the stage of where we as a planet are finding ways for everyone to win instead of just one hemisphere, or instead of just one flag, or instead of just one pigmentation, or instead of one DNA set, or, you know, I want to live in that era.
Yes, great era. It's a big dream. I hope we will see. We'll see. Yes, and how you told, like my 7-year-old son, sometimes he's asking me, mommy, when you will die? I told him, Rodion, like 135, because like, and I believe because like, you know, it depends on my brain, my health, like my mindset. And of course about technology and about everything what's happened in pharmacy industry. And like, yes, it will support me. And maybe one day we will see this era when, yes, we will be more humanity. And like, yes, it will not be like not just about like sometimes money, success, or like something.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, I'm not hopeful in my lifetime.
Yeah. Yes.
I've worked with far too many multinationals and far too many governments to know that that's how people are really thinking. But I also think there's a chance, because I told myself that I'm going to ask whatever comes out of that question. It's kind of like a game of whispers, right? So I'm going to actually ask that question about whether or not human are a worthwhile to the universe invention. So it's going to be, I'm putting it in the chat here for you. So here it is. And you may have to show this because Buckminster Fuller was a philosopher and a scientist in the 1950s, came up with the geodesic dome. He's the first one to create the concept of spaceship Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Penang, Malaysia, and I met a poster of something he wrote on a napkin when he was visiting there in 1983. And so I took a picture of that. And for about 5 years, whenever I was traveling and I met somebody, the third beer, three beers mm-hmm. drunk, and yeah. I would ask this question. So the question is, you know, whether humanity is to continue and comprehensively prosper on spaceship Earth depends entirely on the integrity of the human individuals and not on the political and economic systems. The cosmic question has been asked. Are humans a worthwhile to the universe invention? And so we could be like the plague for the planet and we just destroy everything.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could continue to grow and get off this planet and start to meet other planets. And
mm-hmm.
so, yeah. So my question is, are we a worthwhile to the universe invention
or
are we going to burn this thing down?
Yes. Great question. It's like so philosophy, right? Like, so I love it. Yes. Yes, Jimbo. And guess what? Like, we've done. We made it. Thank you so much for this really so deep conversation. And like, it was so fast and so simple for me to talk to you like about everything. Thank you so much.
Entirely my pleasure. You know, I think you and I are both pretty good at making initial connections. But you're right. I found the conversation to be natural. And I felt bad because, you know, it's been 2 hours and it felt like 45. So every now and again, I would look up and like, oh, shoot, I must talk less. But it was just so much fun. So thank you so much for staying awake and staying energized. And I really had a fabulous time.
Thank you again for Jimbo and all my listeners for being part of our podcast family. Stay tuned for more captivating episodes brimming with engaging conversations and inspiring narratives. Until next time, take care, stay curious, and keep shining brightly. Bye.